Founding support for The Reading Life comes from Octavia Books. Additional support comes from the Helles Foundation and the Louisiana Endowment for the Humanities, the state affiliate of the National Endowment for the Humanities. Hello and welcome to The Reading Life, your weekly look at the Louisiana literary scene. I'm Susan Larson. This week we have A Perfect Valentine, a book that's a love story about a writer and a photographer and the city that inspired both of them. I'm looking forward to talking with Dalt Wonk and Josephine Sacabo, whose new book is New Orleans, 1970 to 2020. Happy to welcome Dalt Wonk and Josephine Sacabo to The Reading Life to celebrate their book, New Orleans 1970 to 2020. It's not often we get to enjoy a book that chronicles 50 years of life in New Orleans from such practiced, keen observers. Dalt is a freelance journalist who's written for many publications. He's also known for his charming French Quarter fables, his children's book The Laughing Lady, and his plays, which have been collected in Dangerous Gardenias. We know Josephine for her gorgeous black and white photography, often inspired by literature. Her work has appeared in more than 40 exhibitions and is included in the permanent collections of many museums. Josephine and Dalt also operate Luna Press, where they create beautiful, beautiful books. Dalt, Josephine, welcome.
Thank you,
Susan. Thank you. Great to
be here. Really nice to be here.
Oh, well, 50 years. Yeah. 50 years.
Yeah.
It's a lot. And you have, without a doubt, the best How I Got to New Orleans story, which you start with. So talk a little bit about that, Dalt.
Well, we were living in France where we bought a...
Oh, boo-hoo.
No, boo-hoo, yeah. In the south of France was called Languedoc, which is over towards Spain. We bought a house way back when for $1,800.
Wow.
And we didn't have much money at the time, so that left us $1,000 to fix it. And it needed a whole lot of fixing. So we worked and worked and worked, and finally we had a place where we could live without paying rent. And that was fabulous. And I'm a playwright, and Josephine was a great actress, and she did a lot of lead roles for me, in fact. And so we were doing theater in London and living in France in the summers, and I'd write a new play, and then we'd do it in London. And then there was a certain time came where I thought, you know, we really ought to get back to the States, right? Because the thing about being an expatriate, it's wonderful in a lot of ways, but it's unclear what you can do legally, particularly when it comes to earning money. And so Josephine, she was so happy in France, she didn't want to come back. And finally, one day she said, okay, I'll go back if we can go to New Orleans. Now, she had been to New Orleans once as a kid with someone else's driver's license so she could drink. And I had never been to New Orleans. We didn't know anybody in New Orleans. And I said, you go back if we go to New Orleans? Fine, we'll go to New Orleans. Now, as a playwright, that was a little bit odd because it's not known as a theater city like, say, Chicago is, for instance. But it turned out to be just so wonderful. And so we got here and we didn't even unpack because we didn't know if we were staying. And now, over 40 years later, we're adopted natives.
But you came here on a freighter.
Well, yeah.
He came all the way.
I did not like it. Yeah. Josephine jumped ship because she didn't like being the only lady on a ship full of men. And we had a lot of bad weather. And so she got off in Spain and she flew over. It was quite an adventure. And I'm actually illegal in the United States because the ship that I was on, it got stuck before at the bottom of the Mississippi River, then finally got unstuck. And we came up, and so I was up on the bridge talking to one of the officers, and I said, oh, there's a city. That's nice. What is it? He said, that's New Orleans. I said, we don't seem to be stopping. He said, no, there's been a change of plans. I said, what? Now, I knew that Josephine was in New Orleans, a city she didn't know. She didn't have much money. She didn't know anybody there. And we went up to Burnside, which is about 60 miles upriver, because that's where they load cargo. Well, I thought I was really kind of desperate because there was a problem with the ship-to-shore radio, so I could hardly talk to Josephine. So somebody came in a launch to drop some things off at the ship, and the guys who did that climbed down the rope ladder, and I ran in, got my suitcase, and I climbed down the rope ladder too. So I'm actually illegal.
You jumped ship.
I jumped ship. Yeah, so... when we got to the shore, they were getting into their pickup trucks, and I said to the least hostile-looking one, is there some place I can catch a bus to New Orleans? And he said, yeah, the Greyhound station, I'll take you. So that's what happened. So then I had to find Josephine, who was living above Chris Owens's place. Somehow
we got it together.
So we had to earn some money, so I became a journalist. I had been a playwright before that, but I became a journalist, and it worked out. New Orleans Magazine at the time had been taken over by Ginny Hardy. She was great. And Tom Bethel, an Englishman, was the managing editor. And so I started doing journalism, and it all worked out some kind of way.
For a long, long time.
For a long, long time.
I mean, you arrived in 1973.
Yeah, 73. Yeah.
That is fantastic.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's my favorite arrival story of anybody. I hear all the time about people, I'm coming down the Mississippi, I'll be getting out of my boat at Jackson Square. But this one, it's different.
Yeah. Yes, it is
The fact that it worked seems miraculous.
Out, you know,
because
really.
New Orleans, we had looked at some books about New Orleans, but all the cars and the pictures were like from the 40s.
Yeah, and but it, we didn't know that.
Well, you could see that the cars were from the 40s.
I didn't know
but,
it.
But the question was, well, is it still that wonderful? And it didn't take long to realize it is still that wonderful. So here we are.
So tell us about the quarter in the 70s. Those were some really great times.
Yeah. Well, when I arrived, I went to the quarter. That's where you went. And mm-hmm. I mean, I was just amazed by how beautiful it was. And I was so glad because I thought, oh, God, you know, what if this is one big mistake that we've made?
Yeah.
It wasn't fancy. It's so fancy, of course. And there weren't a lot of tourists. I didn't see any. But what it was, it just was like still a neighborhoody. A lot of Italian mm-hmm. people, shops, you know, like the, what are they called? The people?
Mom and pop shops. Yeah.
No, yeah. Well, a lot of Italian stores and a lot of, it just still had that feeling of, mm-hmm. of being, I don't know, a little bit European, but also a little bit from the islands. I don't know. It was uh-huh. just like, okay,
Caribbean.
I'm staying here. This is good. Well, and it was good to us, you know. It was...
Right. And the thing is, at that point, the port was still the main industry. And what the big change was when tourism became the main industry. Mm-hmm. And that kind of changed everything. Like the French Quarter changed so pretty radically from then on.
But we used to go to good restaurants to eat.
Buster's.
I love that you went to Buster's.
Buster's was one of them. There were restaurants on Bourbon Street mm-hmm. that were locally owned. It was wonderful. And, you know, there was a theater. We went to the theater. There was actually theater going on. And there was, you know, it was really beautiful. It still
and
is what we are.
You used to see Tennessee Williams just
all
walking
the time.
Around,
yeah.
right?
Well, and I'd go and just stand next to him.
He lived on the
Barris
next... He lived on the next block.
Yeah.
And his doorbell said T. Williams.
But he used to go walk on Royal Street and window shop like we all do. And whenever I would see him, I would go just so I could stand next to him. Wonky would be like, oh, my God, he's going to... What is he going to think she's doing? But... He never noticed me, so it was fine.
If you're just joining us, my guests are Dot Wonk and Josephine Sacabo. Their new book is New Orleans, 1970 to 2020. Besides being a way to support yourself, Dot, it seems that the journalism you did was a lot of the kind of journalism people do when they move to a new place. Mm-hmm. They want to understand it, so they seek out certain things. You did a lot of wide-ranging things that anybody would if they were discovering the city, like Creoles of Color.
Yeah.
That's a really long you know, complicated explication.
Well, and a lot of these things happen in the strangest ways. Then there was Tom Fitzmaurice became the editor. Mm-hmm. And he said, I hear that in the black world that what color people are matters, and why don't you do something? I thought, oh, my God, the last thing I want to do is go talk to people about what color they are. But it turned out to be a key to the whole city mm-hmm. from its whole history. And so it turned out to be really wonderful.
And you wrote about the coroner. Of course. How do we get so many colorful coroners?
I know. What's with always... the coroner? Yeah.
Yeah, who played the trumpet.
Was it the trumpet he played?
Yeah.
Yeah.
I swear.
A neighbor, too.
Yeah, he was a neighbor, too.
And then stuff like Wembley ties.
Yeah.
I mean.
Well, you know, you just, very often what happens is something comes out, you have a story. They had a story I was supposed to do about some Italian group, and I really didn't want to do it because it just sounded boring. And it turned out that they were fascinating, this group. So you just never know what you're going to find. Mm-hmm. And some of the things that you think are boring and you don't want to do turn out to be fascinating. So it was a great way to see the city, to mm-hmm. learn about the city.
And you went across the lake, rather, to St. Joseph Abbey, which I loved reading about.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, that was fascinating.
Is that still there?
Mm-hmm.
That was fascinating, yeah.
He could do another story if he wanted. And you also have a long, wonderful piece about John Kennedy Toole and the whole Confederacy of Dunces story.
Oh, yes.
Talk about writing about that.
Well, what happened was I was in kind of a nervous breakdown. I did a play called Shangri-La with Charles Neville. He had gotten $1,500 from the Jazz Fest to do a play about a nightclub, a black nightclub in the 50s. And another friend, Vernell Banyaris, who did One More Time, he was having some actors improvise it. And I said, oh, okay. And then I get a call from Vernell, and he said, it's not working out. Everything they come up with is boring and stupid. We needed a playwright. And Charles said, what about Dalt? And I said, wait a minute. This is a play about a black nightclub under segregation. Does he know I'm white? And Vernell said, yeah, he knows who you are. And I said, well, if he's crazy enough to ask me, I'm crazy enough to try it. And so we did Shangri-La, and he put together this fabulous band of with Deacon John and a mm-hmm. bunch of other people. And I wrote a script, and I passed it on to Ted Gilliam, who was the founder and the artistic director of Dashiki Theater, a black theater company. Mm-hmm. He wasn't interested. I thought, you're not interested in doing a play with Charles Neville? So I went back to Charles and I said, he's not interested in doing it. I don't know any other black directors. And Charles said, well, you direct it, Dalt. And I thought, God, I'm a white guy who wrote a black play and now I'm going to direct it. What if someone says, oh, a black person wouldn't say that, or a black person wouldn't do that, or that? It never happened. We got on fine. And Lady BJ, one of the wonderful singers, I grabbed her immediately, and she did the lead role. I mean, there was no one else quite like BJ. She was amazing. She could raise the roof without a microphone. I mean, and one night, we almost had no band. There was some problem, and so it was just Charles. And I said, BJ, you don't have to go out and do this number. And she said, oh, come on, Dalt, I'll do it. And she picked up a tambourine and went out there and did the number. I mean, BJ was wonderful.
Yeah, she was.
And so were a lot of the other people.
Well, there's a who's who in this book of people you've known over the years. Yeah, so it's so incredible. Yeah. And there's also a generous selection of your photographs, Josephine. So talk about how you chose the ones that went into this book.
Well, you know, they weren't to illustrate any of the things because I was on a separate track myself. I was so fascinated with the French Quarter. I mean, I couldn't help it. And I was involved with Baudelaire's Splendid Paris and all of that. And so, you know, by being the person that strolls around and sees, which is that Baudelaire's thing. Mm-hmm. And when I got to the Quarter, I thought, God, this is what Baudelaire was talking about. You walk around and you see this, and then you talk to this one, and then there's the old lady who does this, and she can't move. So then there's the guy that picks her up every day. And it just seemed like a reincarnation of that thing that the Baudelaire had done. So that's sort of what inspired me originally. And just walking around the quarter, everywhere I looked, there was a photograph. It was a given, you know. So I just was doing that on my own. And I was kind of naive, too, about the sentimentality in the sense that there were some things going on that I failed to see early on, like drug dealing and stuff. Mm-hmm. And once I got wind of all of that and that I became more aware, it took a while, a couple of years, I started seeing the dark side of it. And I thought, I don't want to keep documenting the dark side of this unless I'm going to do something about it. I decided at that point, I want to see something beautiful. And if that's the case, I'm going to have to make it.
And you feel that these are the most beautiful of the beautiful?
Yes. Yeah.
That's...
Yeah. It was so easy, really, in a way, because it was all there, you know?
Well, you're so open. I mean, it's so lovely the way some of these people are looking right at you.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
You know? And so many of these people I noticed were talking.
Yeah.
Which I loved.
Yes, yes, yes.
I could imagine.
How about the old lady?
One ear cocked.
Right. Well, there was one old lady that would talk to the blind man. She was an old, and it's in there. And she would come every day and talk, and he would be so bored. He'd be going, But he was blind and he had his thing. And she would tell him, and then at that restaurant down there, they're closing the doors early. I don't know what's going on. So every day she would come to that corner, and I knew where they were, and tell him everything that was going on that he could have cared less. But it was, you know, things like that happened a lot. Canal Street was a dream. All those old ladies and the place.
The shops, the stores that were
there.
Then.
Yeah. And what's the name of that store that was not Maison Blanche, but the other one?
Krause's. The department store.
Huh?
There were two other department
Krause's
stores.
Krause's at the end.
Yeah. Well, they had a room inside for women in the bathroom where ladies, all these lonely old ladies, went there every day and sat there all day long and visited with each other. And I would go and sit there and just listen to them. And it was wonderful. What a wonderful thing. A world I would never have had access to otherwise. I mean,
see, you were right to choose this place.
Yeah. Yeah.
No regrets, I hope.
No regrets. No, no regrets. The only a little bit of pain every time I think of I'm not living in France is I was very happy in France.
It sounds like you were.
Yeah.
Gypsies.
Yes.
I mean, really. What was it like to look back at so much of your work? How did it make you feel? Be honest.
To look back at that work? You mean, you're asking me? I'm proud of it. And made me feel proud, and I'm really glad I did it. And there are a lot of people that they love that about me, and they don't like anything else I've ever done.
The thing is, Josephine, so we were trying to make some money, and the French Quarter was cheap back in those days. It's hard to remember. We had a little place for $150 a month on Burgundy Street. It was in a slave quarter. When Josephine, for the Courier or the Figaro or other, they would send her out to take pictures, but those pictures, she would do what they needed, and they were great from that point of view. But it was the pictures that she took when she was just wandering on her own.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Those were the ones that are in the book, because that was a very special thing that really came out of her reaction to the French Quarter, which we both loved at the time.
Still do.
And still do.
Still do, yeah.
We're lucky. We live in what's become a very narrow part of the French Quarter that's still, we love our neighbors,
still
our neighbors love us,
it's
and it's
a neighborhood.
Yep. And it's quiet, except weekends, or when you know, some celebrities in town and they're all down there carrying on. But it's still a wonderful place to live.
And you have very thick walls, as I remember.
Oh, yes.
So,
yes, yes.
We still have a bit of quiet, peace and quiet. But I'm just curious to have you talk about the change in the quarter now. What is it like living there?
Well, where we live, which the lower quarter, which that is to say near Esplanade, it's still a neighborhood.
But you're not seeing Tennessee Williams anymore.
No.
Nope.
No, alas, no. But I mean...
No, but we were hanging out with Jessica Lange. Hey.
That's great.
And we became really good friends because we lived in that area, so that was nice. But really, we don't mix with the rest of the quarter much. Actually, truth to tell. At least for me, it's the quarter in City Park or New Orleans for me.
Yeah. Do you have, I mean, can you imagine ever leaving now?
Well, we love Mexico. We go down to Mexico. We bought a house in Mexico. And it's really quite wonderful. The thing is that Josephine grew up in Laredo, which is a town on the Mexican border, and everybody speaks both languages. And Mexico is wonderful, and that's been a great thing to do. But New Orleans
is home.
Is home, for sure.
However, we don't know what this is going to be like in the next year or two. So the idea is we do have Mexico in case, you know, Trump runs us out of town for whatever reason. You know.
You're holding up a finger in the air, which is say we don't know what it's going to be like.
Yeah.
So, Josephine, I'm often curious why you haven't written a memoir. You're a wonderful writer.
Oh, thank you. I'm private, kind of. Whatever I have to say about my feelings about different things, I'd rather do it in pictures.
It's all in the image.
Yeah. That's really how I feel about it. You want to know who I am? If you're really curious about who I am, look at these pictures, and that's the best I can.
And look long and hard.
Yeah, look. But I don't like writing an artist statement. I make pictures of texts that are saying exactly what I think. When I'm making the picture, it's been like I don't even know. Sometimes I'm making a picture and I don't know quite why I want it. And suddenly there'll be a line from Rilke or somebody.
Yeah.
And I'll think, yes, that's exactly what I want to say.
So the words of others have given you the tool to make the image.
Yes, yeah, absolutely. Yeah. I don't like to write.
But you're good at it.
Thank you.
Josephine is good at everything she puts her hand to. It's really quite amazing. She was my leading lady. She was great on stage, and she could do serious things, and she could do comedy. And so we worked together a lot. And then we went back to France, and someone had left a camera there in this house that we had bought for $1,800. And she picked it up and started taking pictures. And do you know that from her very first role, she was taking really wonderful pictures? And it just so happened that there was one other foreigner living in this village of 100 people, an Englishman, quite wonderful, eccentric Englishman, who was a professional photographer. And so I built in the bathroom, which I had also built, I built a dark room for Josephine. And this Harold Chapman, the English photographer, used to come over and have dinner with us and look at Josephine's pictures and give her advice. And so she had a tutorial with an amazing photographer.
He was the assistant to Cartier-Bresson.
Yeah, he was something.
So he taught me photography and criticized my things, and he built a dark room in the bathroom, so if I wanted to work, I could pull this thing down from the wall, but then sometimes there was a naked man in the bathtub underneath that I had to chase out.
Now, who was that naked
man?
I've always wondered.
Who was the naked man in the tub? Right. Oh, my God.
We only have one picture of that.
But one of the stories I liked a lot was the story of having Iris, your daughter. Her birth.
Yeah.
When you came home and said, could you run down and get a pack of cigarettes?
Yes. Because I'm going to smoke between
and
here.
And Dahl said, that's it, baby.
I'm going to smoke the whole pack between
given,
here and
well,
the hospital.
The thing is, just so everyone understands, when she was pregnant, she gave up smoking. She had smoked since she was a teenager. She gave up smoking because she was worried about the baby and smoke. And then one day, she says to me, Wonk, would you go down to the corner and get a pack of cigarettes? And I thought, oh, that can only mean one thing. And we had this secondhand sports car that sometimes started and sometimes didn't. And I thought, dear Lord, make it start. We got to get this girl to the hospital.
And so we have Iris, who's now a writer in her own work.
And so we have Iris. Wonderful Iris.
Best thing in my life.
Yeah.
Pretty great thing. We've been talking with Dahl Wonk and Josephine Sacabo. Their new book is New Orleans 1970 to 2020, A Portrait of the City by Dahl and Photographs by Josephine. Dahl, Josephine, thank you so much.
Thank you. Yeah.
It's great to see you.
It's a great help. It's a great
thank
help
you.
To get the word out.
Here's Here's what's on tap in the literary life this week. Garden District Bookshop presents Mardi Gras Story Times at 11, Saturday, February 15th, featuring Brenda Robert, author of King of the Shoebox Parade, and Saturday, February 15th at 1, featuring Melissa Thibault, author of 12 Days of Mardi Gras. Poet Gina Ferrara will host four colleagues from the poetry world, Nicole Iden, Valentine Pierce, Charisma Price, and Andy Young, at a reading Saturday, February 15th at 2 at the Old Metairie Library on Metairie Road. The Liminal Reading Series presents Constance Adler, Max Giolino, Joshua Gottlieb Miller, Carolyn Hembry, and Nikki Ummel. Sunday, February 16th at 6 p.m. at the Domino, 3044 St. Claude Avenue. The Mystery Book Club that meets at the Old Metairie Library has announced the books its members will read in the upcoming months. The first is The Stranger by Harlan Coben. The first meeting takes place Tuesday, February 18th from 2 to 4. Anyone can join the group, which meets the third Tuesday of each month at the Old Metairie Library on Metairie Road. Former Louisiana Poet Laureate Julie Kane signs Naked Ladies, New and Selected Poems, Tuesday, February 18th at 6 at Garden District Bookshop. Tamika Mallory discusses and signs I Live to Tell the Story, a memoir of love, legacy, and resilience, Thursday, February 20th at 6 at Baldwin & Company. Founding support for The Reading Life comes from Octavia Books. Additional support comes from the Hellis Foundation, the Jefferson Parish Public Library, and the Louisiana Endowment for the Humanities, the state affiliate of the National Endowment for the Humanities. Any views, findings, conclusions, or recommendations expressed in The Reading Life do not necessarily represent those of the National Endowment for the Humanities. The theme song for The Reading Life is by Matt Perrine and Sunflower City. The Reading Life is produced by George Ingmeyer and is a production of WWNO. You can listen to us anytime or subscribe to our podcast at wwno.org. And you can email us at thereadinglife@wwno.org.